is not a drill. This is not a drill. General quarters. General quarters. All hands on your battle station.
Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime.
And welcome aboard, everybody. This is the aforementioned Sal, along with my ever-genial co-host, Eagle One of Eagle Speak, and we greatly appreciate you taking time this afternoon to join us for another edition of Midrats. And if you are so inclined, while you're on the show page, if you're live, if you scroll down to the bottom of the show page, that's where you will find access to the chat room. And if there is an observation you would like to make or even a question you would like for us to address to our guests that you don't think we're quite going to get to, that's a great place to put it. We'll be monitoring that during the course of the show. And we usually have some of our former guests and usual suspects are in the chat room as well. And if you've got to run off and take care of some business and you want to catch up on what you missed on the show, you can always get the full archive over Blog Talk Radio or take the shortcut and subscribe to the free podcast over at iTunes or Stitcher. Now let's going to just dive right into today's show. And a little phrase that a lot of people have heard over the course of the last year or so, but I think it's funny, is the 1980s has gotten some of its foreign policy back. And when you look back at the 80s, there is also something that we've talked about here and there over the last few years on Midrats that also came from the 80s. It defines the entire structure of our military. And, of course, that is the Goldwater-Nichols Act of 1986. And a question that's always fun to address is here we are in the second half of the second decade of the 21st century, but we and our structure and how we try to meet our national security means on the military side is defined by something back when people wore day glow clothing, had big hair, and Chrysler's K-Car was still cutting edge of technology. And organizations should always evolve and try to refine the systems that define it. And is our present system creating conditions that our uniformed senior leadership can forge the best path as they see it to utilize that military lever of national power? And we have a returning guest today that we're going to explore that question with, and it's M.L. Cavanaugh, Major, United States Army. And Matt comes from us as a U.S. Army strategist. He has global experience and assignments ranging from the Pentagon to Korea to Iraq a couple of times, and also his current post is at the U.S. Army Space and Missile Defense Command. He's a non-resident fellow with the Modern War Institute at West Point, where he provides regular commentary and analysis. He's also a contributor to our friends over at War on the Rocks, and Matt's writing has appeared in the New York Times, USA Today, Chicago Tribune, and at foreignpolicy.com, and a few other places scattered hither and yon. He graduated from West Point in 2002, and after that, he has continued his academic pursuits with a master's degree at Victoria University in Wellington, New Zealand, and is currently at work on his D dissertation on Supreme Command under Professor Emeritus Colin Gray at the University of Reading in the United Kingdom. You can find Matt over at mlcavanaugh.com, and he can always be reached via Twitter at mlcavanaugh.com. And final little note here before we bring Matt on. Matt is a major in the U.S. Army, but his opinions here are his alone and do not represent the U.S. Army, DOD, or any of the organizations that he is associated with. Matt, welcome back to Midrats.
Hey, thank you so much. And you should know my decision model for this sort of thing is either heck yeah or no. There's no in between. And for Midrats, it's always a heck yeah. And you know, this is episode, before we get going, this is episode 365, and you guys both deserve great credit for what you're doing for the profession. And just as a little side note to that, when the royalty checks get cut, I think that leaves me with like a half a percentage point. So I really appreciate being on again. So thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Matt. We appreciate that. And we'll get your royalty check to you by a Cabela's.
Yeah.
Hey, wait a minute.
We get paid to do this?
You don't, and that's what makes you guys A-okay and perfect in my mind. We'll leave the Navy thing aside.
Well, thank you. Everybody has their crosses to bear, and we won't talk about football or anything like that.
No, we won't. I will resist the temptation to bring it up every 5 minutes or so, but you should know that I'm a 2002 graduate from West Point, so December of 2001 was the last time we won before this year. That was my first senior year in college, and I'm not a young kid anymore, so it really has been a long time. It's amazing to me, so that's the shocking story of 2016, if you ask me. But
yep, and I don't think anybody who is an Army fan or a Cubs fan can say anything bad about 2016.
No, they can't.
and again, thank you very much for the kind words. We do appreciate it. Time flies, as we like to say. As a scene setter for today's show, if you say to a lot of people, even those with a military background, you know, we need a general staff, a lot of them will look at you kind of sideways and go, well, wait, we have a Joint Chiefs of Staff. Isn't that roughly the same thing? If you could, for the listener, describe the development of the concept of the general staff as traditionally known and compare it to our model of a Joint Chiefs of Staff, and what are those significant differences that divide the two?
So, and that's actually one of the objections that I've received on my the essay that was written. And I think it's probably best if I start from the start, which is to say, you should never assume that someone has read something that you've written. So let me go back to the beginning where, you know, how I intersected with the subject. So I started looking at it from the broadest perspective. You know, what do organizations do to get better? How do we improve our performance? And I've read a little bit by Gary Klein, who's a psychologist that's done some work for the Air Force and the Department of Defense writ large on expertise. And, you know, he has a very simple equation that you're looking to reduce errors and uncertainty, and you're looking to increase your organization's insights. And I think that the military focuses on the reduction of errors and uncertainty overwhelmingly. You know, you've heard the phrase zero defects, and we often overlook or exclude increasing our insights. And we often either outsource our insights or they're sort of ad hoc cobbled together. So when I say outsourced, I mean think tanks like, for example, you know, the classic example in the last decade and a half is the American Enterprise Institute and the Institute for the Study of War, and their people having a role in the development of the surge. When I say ad hoc, I mean sort of a team of colonels rapidly called together to study, for example, Iraq and how not so great things were going for Chairman of the Joint Chiefs Peter Pace about a decade ago. Or, you know, the joint strategic assessment teams that have come together for various commanders in Afghanistan. So in my mind, the largest problem, the biggest problem from the largest global, you know, the biggest perspective is that for geographic and institutional reasons, we've dispersed our military strategic talent in commands and staffs across the globe. And I, you know, term this death by a thousand commanders initiatives groups. So each, you know, individual commander or senior military officer often has his own personal staff of 3 to 5 to 6 to 10 individuals. But, you know, they're sort of little bits and pieces that are everywhere. that's our mechanism for increasing our insights. But we have no central hub for our finest military minds to tackle our toughest problems. And that's where the general staff comes in. In my mind, a general staff has sort of, there's a formal function, which I'll get to in a moment, and there's an informal function, and that informal function is what I'm getting at, that you're creating a nexus between our best folks and our toughest issues. When I look out at the landscape, there are a few organizations that are doing this. The Department of Defense is not one of them. One of them, in my mind, that is Google X. And they're producing breakthroughs. They are a company that looks as though that they will survive in a competitive future. And similarly, I think that the military might learn from that. That we would want to create an organization of about 100 to 150 uniformed individuals, not too big, but large enough to maintain a stable, cohesive group, selected competitively for diversity, emphasis on collaboration. And you'd want a balanced, proportional portfolio of experiences and folks from each of the principal services, including the National Guard, the Reserve, and the Coast Guard. One of the key distinguishing features, though, would be that it would privilege strategic ability over age. And that, in many ways, in my mind, is one of our greatest challenges in the military, in the uniform, that we often overlook great ideas because they come from folks with lesser or lower rank. And interestingly, when you look back at the folks that have been awarded the Nobel Prize, and the National Bureau of Economic Research here in the U.S. has looked at the 2,000 Nobel Prize winners back through history, and they found that the insight that they came up with that later was to earn them the Nobel came between the ages of 35 and 39. In our military, some of our great minds have come from younger folks. And so in my mind, the establishment of a general staff is more to this larger issue of increasing insights and leveraging youthful ideas and putting our best folks at our toughest problems. Let's get back to the formal portion of the presentation that you asked about. This is the number one criticism that I've seen, that what I've recommended is not a general staff. It's not like the Germans had, for example, I am not recommending that we consolidate command authority of the armed forces in one central body headquartered in Washington, D.C. That's true. I am diverging from the German tradition. But history should inform us, but not control us. It doesn't make sense for today for the American military to recreate the German general staff's characteristics of 70 years ago or 100 years ago. Our challenges are global, truly global, while theirs was a two-front war and encirclement. And so there it made sense from a geographic standpoint to perhaps centralize your resources because your biggest problem was that pivot, right? That inflection from west to east or west east to west. And besides, German traditions are made to be broken, often at American gunpoint. In my mind, we ought to think new. A general staff is not limited to what the Germans did 70 or 100 years ago. Our problems are different, and so our solutions will look different too. And then, as an extension of that, our commitments are so diverse and so distant that, to my mind, the current Geographic Combatant Command and Joint Staff System probably shouldn't change, and I don't think it will change. I doubt it. It probably won't change. All wars are local. I spent the last year in Korea before this present assignment, and nothing sharpens the mind like the presence of an enemy's nuclear and artillery guillotine. And so there's incredible value in devolving some geographic responsibility to commands that are closest in proximity to the problem. So I don't necessarily think that we should look to recreate the German general staff system. I think the what I'm driving at, what I'm hammering towards, is much simpler, much smaller. Another version of that first objection is that this is a great idea. You know, great idea, Matt, but it's not enough. We definitely, aside from the German thing, we need to reform the joint staff. We need Goldwater Nichols 2.0, and we need to put the chairman in the chain of command. And I get this. War has expanded beyond geography in many ways to wars in the commons and the extreme commons, like space. And we have all these critical assets, like special operations forces, ISR, space, and cyber, that are not tied to geography, that have to get moved from theater to less concerned with what should be done, or, you know, what someone's values would dictate, than what can be done now. And the suggestion that I raised in my essay doesn't require major muscle movements or likely even any kind of legislation. It would be an experiment. Just let's stand it up unofficially, and if there's value, keep it. And if not, then dump it. I think that we focus on major legislative changes. We hold hearings and we argue and we sort of fight, and partially that's because there's it's so difficult for folks to envision that you might just create something to try it out. And in my mind, I think that's the value of this idea, that it's not the end of the world if it doesn't work out. It's like, and beyond that, some of the criticisms have been to call it a super SIG or CAG, a strategic initiatives group or commander's action group, you know, which is those smaller staffs that I mentioned. So that's been one of the criticisms, that I'm talking about isn't a true general staff. But I think that criticism is just tied to the German model. Call it what you will, but I think it's worth giving it a shot. Let them work for the chairman or the Secretary of Defense, or even put them under the Office of Net Assessment and work for Mr. Baker. And then lastly, the last objection that I've gotten is the one of apathy, that things are fine. If I could hit it with a 2x4, I would. Any real reflection of our recent track record documents large opportunities for improvement. From the business world, even the business world recognizes this. Jeff Bezos has said on camera that he doesn't believe his company is going to exist in the next few decades. You know, that if you're not disrupting yourself, someone else will. And that's in the business world. In our profession, people die. And that's, to me, if we're not continually looking for the better, then that's our problem. We're too important to fail. So in my mind, we ought to recognize the disproportionate impact of the right few. I would rather have a strategic SWAT team, come together than an army of box checkers, or, you know, I really want to bring together this strategic talent that I know exists. It just hasn't come together yet for those disproportionate impacts that I believe that they might provide. So I'm sorry if I didn't get too much into the detail on the historical traditional definition of a general staff, but in my mind, much of the history is discontinuous, or it just doesn't fit for us. Not the way that the American military sits today.
Well, that raises a really good question, though. What I mean, you're calling it a general staff, and historically, even the Germans, I mean, they never incorporated the naval forces under their general staff, as I understand it. How you know, you're talking, I think in your article, I think Sal put up a link to it at the chat room. You're talking about 100 to 150 individuals to be on this staff, and I assume that you're not limiting this just to the Army and other ground forces, but you would incorporate all the services in this staff in your way of thinking about it?
Absolutely. And here's sort of the difference. In my mind, our responsibilities are just so dissimilar from what the German tradition was that it's just an inappropriate fit in a formal sense, you know, in a command authority sense. The informal part of that, though, is that those officers were chosen for a reason. I mean, this was the creme de la creme. This is, in terms of strategic talent, it was an intellectual assignment that was prized and valued and fought over. And that does not exist in our military. One thought, you know, I mentioned this as a throwaway line. We lavishly fund black ops, but we sure don't lavishly fund brain ops. You know, there's entire industries, some of it book publishing and movie industries, built off of our finest tactical talent. But we don't have that same Cadillac luster that gets applied to our strategic talent. And I know it exists out there. I mean, we have these people. They do exist, but in my mind, they're disconnected and disorganized. So when we truly need insights, we rely on think tanks, and we rely on ad hoc come together pickup teams of officers that are really sort of, you know, they're informally brought together. Wouldn't it be great if we had a system that recognized and put that strategic talent together so that it was ready when the moment arose? Back to your comment about the German model, you know, the Navy not finding itself a part of the staff. In my mind, this has to be a very diverse group of folks, because whereas I've tried my best, my darndest, to understand naval operations and the air and the Marine Corps as well, the intersection of air, land, and sea, I don't know. There's so much I don't know that I, you know, and I really feel that it would just add so much value, not just to have the most intelligent folks, but the folks with the right group of people with different intelligences, because it's not just about how intelligent you are. It's how are you intelligent? You know, there are folks that know subsurface warfare like the back of their hand. And while many might dismiss, there's value in tactical and operational knowledge as well. It's, you know, I don't want to just put together a club of folks that are thinking in the clouds. I want ideas that are connected to reality and the things that can be achieved in the real world. So I would want cyber folks, I would want space folks, I would want missileers from the Air Force, I would want air, land, and sea, the Coast Guard. I would certainly want a diverse group to put together. The figure that I applied, the 100 to 150, in my mind, this has to be a very cohesive group. And right now I think the joint staff is almost 3,000 people or thereabouts. It's around 3,000. That's too large. It's just too large. It becomes its own another bureaucracy. For what this group would seek to achieve, I think that you would prefer to have a smaller group. More is not better if less is enough, and I think this is the right figure.
This question might be a little more rambling, even more than usual, but you hit on something that set off a few things in my head, and I think, Matt, you are spot on that, and I don't think institutionally we've really wrestled with this as much as we have, and that was the indications and warnings that were very clear during the development of the plan for the Iraq surge, that we have a problem internally developing not just intellectual capabilities that we have, but also the right personalities and incentive to, like we've ever weaponized that intellect, where we had to outsource to think tanks. We did have to look to Jack Keane wandering around like a ghost in D.C. with his briefing papers and a brush salesman's briefcase trying to get some ideas out, that there is a mentality or a mindset or a habit that maybe needs to be looked at as well. In my personal experience, and I'd also like you to talk about the school for a little bit when I mention it here, but this was the 08-09 time frame at HQ ISAF in Kabul, a year plus of planning for the surge, and it was right in the beginning part of the surge was coming up. And General McKernan said, summer of 08, go get me a couple of SAMS graduates here now as we put this on the operational end. And SAMS, the School for Advanced Military Studies. So, I mean this of all the love in the world if either one of these individuals winds up listening to this show. But so we got a couple of them that came in, smart guys and gals, just intelligent, full of ideas. They were evidently some of the top guys and gals who were available. They came out of SAM schools, but they were majors. And going to Qatar and back and forth, there was a problem getting them to engage in the Cub, in the briefing room, with ideas, contrary concepts. They would come have little sidebars in the background, but they couldn't break through that wall of being able to step forward and really engage. And as a result, they just got rolled by Brit lieutenant colonels, your random RAF guy, Army reservist who had the different personality type. And I wonder if we want to develop this cadre that you're talking about, there are two ways of doing it, and they're both human capital management challenges. Is one, you've got to have the right people, and I think there has to be an ability to self-identify, because if you only identify these people based upon people at the chain of command, you're going to run into a lot of issues we already see with selection, at least in the Navy, and I'm sure the Army has the same problem. But the ability to develop that intellectual ability that's there, but also how do we develop a culture, and this isn't the culture of senior officers telling people to do it, but being able to either select the personalities that will or create conditions such that your senior captain or your mid-level major is willing to step into a joint combined environment of 05s, 06s, 1-stars, and 2-stars and going, sir, you need to consider the following. Or I'd like to have a sidebar on that, because intellect without action is just, I can't say in mixed company what it is, but I think you know the direction I'm going in.
Yeah, you know, and that's so that sentiment, that feeling is precisely why my sense is that less is more here, that you don't want an overly large group, because what happens in overly large groups is that you fall back on the formality of rank. So one of the most instructive and enlightening experiences that I've had in the military so far was the Basic Strategic Arts Program, which is the Army's School for Strategists. So you go to Carlisle, Pennsylvania for a 4-month long school, and it's a daily class from 9 in the morning until noon, and then the rest of the day after lunch you're expected to do a mountain of reading. So you have class in the morning and reading in the afternoon. But those 16 folks are ranked from captain to senior lieutenant colonel or thereabouts. But the thing that was so wonderful about the class was that we didn't wear uniforms. We wore suits, and you had a name tag. And everybody knew who was ranked what. I went to the class in 2009, so I was a captain. And I was in classes with lieutenant colonels. And just the loss. I mean, we all still had our short haircuts, you know, and everybody knew who was a major and who was a lieutenant colonel and who was a captain. Just the loss of uniforms and that scholarly, informal environment really dropped people's guards to be more receptive to other ideas. And you started to rely less upon the rank structure that you had accumulated by your time in service, and you had to fight with your ideas. You know, your ideas punch beyond their rank, and sometimes, unfortunately, below your rank. Sometimes you have a real stinker, but, you know, that's okay. You get back up off the canvas and you keep going. And that's why, to me, a smaller-sized general staff is of value if you are truly looking to increase insights. One of the essays that I read that ended up on the, you know, a citation or reference that ended up on the cutting room floor, you know, you write something and inevitably stuff gets left to the side. But I learned that in 1959 at MIT, there was a government-affiliated research project on missile defense. And I work at Army Space and Missile Defense Command today, so this was particularly interesting for me. But they were looking into creative approaches to missile defense. You know, this is at the dawn of the missile age, right? The massive armament buildups. But it was also at the dawn of some really, the golden age, really, of science fiction writing. And so one of the affiliated academics knew pretty personally and pretty well Isaac Asimov, and they invited him actually to be part of the group. And Asimov ultimately turned down the invitation, but he did go to the first few meetings or gatherings, and he said, you know, I don't want to be part of the group, but I do think it's worth me sitting down and writing an essay to help you along because I believe in what you're doing. And so he wrote this essay entitled, How Do People Get New Ideas? And it was essentially a blueprint for how you gather or convene a group of individuals and how do you increase insights. And one of the things that he creates as a fulcrum or a foundation point or a touchstone is this sense of informality, that you get people willing to truly exchange ideas. Because sometimes, really, like, new ideas can be scary to put out there and hard to put out there. And sometimes, truly assessing a situation when it's ugly, you know, for example, when Iraq and Afghanistan didn't look so pretty, you know, that's very difficult. And those, that informality, I think, can be, as you put it, weaponized. And I think we have never done that in the military. And I think that's, you know, where I come at what, you know, your your question, that's how I think, you know, we don't necessarily want folks that have come from a particular school. We want folks that have come from many schools, SAMs and otherwise. But I think the one thing we want out of them when they gather is that they feel free to speak their minds and truly create new ideas that we can put to use on a battlefield for the nation's gain.
I'm still working through this stuff, Matt, but I'm envisioning more of a brain trust of smart and well-schooled people, not necessarily a strategic organization. I mean, not a strategic planning organization, but more you're looking for, to me, it sounds like a place to have brainstorming by a cohesive group of people who have divergent backgrounds, but can come up with new ideas to help implement the national strategy as proposed by others. Am I off base on that?
No, you are dead on. And in my mind, the broadest portfolio is best. That this would be a group that would not necessarily be tied to a specific report or document, that they would have projects that would focus on everything not tied to a specific operational geography, and to include strategies and tactics that would feature high impacts and low probabilities. So, for example, one of the big problems, one of the big challenges and questions in Korea is whether or not the North Koreans use a nuke tactically or strategically. You know, are they going to use one to knock down South Korean ROK Army forces? Or are they going to aim at strategic targets, literally destroying the government in Seoul? The Russians and the Chinese, it's not likely, but it's at least possible that they would knock down a satellite or that they would cut some undersea cabling in the Pacific. These are things that are – this is what I mentioned about war expanding, truly expanding into the commons and the extreme commons. Leave the joint staff to the day-to-day operational management concerns. The general staff, you would apply outsized resources and autonomy to take on relevant research, but without a specific nailed-down portfolio. However, geographically, when called upon, they could provide direct support to a combatant commander, just like those strategic assessment teams that I mentioned that became sort of all the rage in Iraq and Afghanistan. So one thing that we know about war and warfare is that it's never what we thought. Secretary Gates used to say, whenever he'd speak, I heard him say it a few times, that we have a 100% prediction rate when it comes to future conflict, and that is that we're wrong 100% of the time. Well, I believe that there is a sort of day-to-day management part of our repertoire that we want to keep going, because someone needs to keep the lights on and someone needs to trade the horses on a daily basis. There ought to be some folks that are thinking about the surprises, because frankly, in early September of 2001, nobody thought we would be at war very shortly in Afghanistan, and thereafter we were. Similarly, there are some black swans out there that I think could, you know, potentially could come to pass, and that a general staff such as how I've thought through it might provide some value. So, but yeah, guilty as charged with your characterization of, you know, how I've thought through the problem. You know, really part of it is my sense that we've been talking about Goldwater Nichols 2.0 for a while now, and the original Goldwater Nichols took a long time to get through. So, you know, let's not do, while everyone's thinking about and talking about the perfect system and how hard it would be to make happen, let's put this experiment out there on the road. I mean, let's live in what we can accomplish today. So that's, you know, that's part of my, and that sounds a little cynical, but I'd stand by it.
One thing we mentioned early on is the, and why the, for a variety of reasons, that the classic model that people think of a German general staff really, you know, doesn't apply here. And part of that, and part of the way that they did things, had to do with the fact that Germany was a continental European power. They really didn't have any type of global considerations that would lead them in any direction to have something similar to what we have with the combatant command. And the only other power that in a modern sense compares to where America is and her responsibilities in 2017 would have been the British Empire from the mid 19th to the mid 20th century. That truly was a global power, global considerations, global concerns, and global conflicts on almost every continent. If you had a chance, and I'm making an assumption here because you are kind of playing with your PhD studies at a UK university, have you had a chance to look at from how they brought and trained their officers to how they structured their strategic plans and goals, the British Empire at its height and its global concerns, as opposed to looking at what the Germans did, are there some things that the British did or did not do at the height of their global concerns that might be of use as we try to develop something that serves our needs today?
You know, specifically, no. But as a general proposition, I think that one thing that I admire about my understanding of the British, that, you know, the height of empire, so to speak, and actually, this is sort of a point of pride, but before we got on air, we were talking about the new house that my wife and I, our family, just moved into a month ago, and it was built in 1899, and I'm proud of that, partially because I know that Winston Churchill went to the Boer War in 1899, so I feel like even if it's indirect and sort of strange, I felt proud at sort of a connection to the British, the experiment in their imperial military. The thing that I admired in my look at how the British handled this challenge was the focus on maintenance, and I think that in the quest for the new, we often overlook the value and the importance of maintenance. And I mean that to say that we have created an immense system over the course of, you know, a couple hundred years as a nation and as a military force in the 70 years since the Second World War. The modern era has a very densely packed history. And I think that the British, as a general, their military in particular, and their political leaders as an offshoot of that, had a greater and keener sense for the maintenance of those international obligations, whether they be formal or informal. And, you know, I don't want to go too much into this because we start to get into sort of very current and contemporary political questions, but I look at the way they saw the world, and I do see value in the system that we've created, the joint staff and the geographic combatant commands, which is part of why you had a guest a little while back that talked about putting the brakes on and rethinking the Goldwater-Nichols 2.0 push. And I agree with that, you know, which I think is sort of a, you know, if I can be so bold, a British sentiment, you know, before you go and change the structure that's in place, think hard about what you want to follow. And in my mind, I don't think we're going to be able to change it. And I don't really think that it's advisable to do so, because the system that was created actually isn't all that bad. I just think that it's missing this important ingredient. So I don't have specifics about, you know, particular staff positions or personalities, but that general British sense of time and space and tradition and, you know, the unintended consequences of major muscle movements, that's something that I take out of the Victorian era.
You mentioned earlier that, or at least in your article, that one suggestion that some people have made apparently is that this function you're looking at could fit under the Office of Net Assessment. And I gather you don't agree with that, but if you don't agree with that, why doesn't it belong in the Office of Net Assessment?
So, good point. So I actually think you could put it there. When I originally wrote the essay, I was looking at the landscape that exists right now. You know, my claim is that we don't have a central hub for our finest minds to tackle our toughest problems. And my evidence is that we don't have one simply. And I looked across the landscape that the Office of Net Assessment kind of gets there, but it's just too small. I mean, it's really, really small. And Lockheed Martin, the Skunk Works lab, is too Air Force centric, and it's private, you know, and they're focused on winning dogfights, not wars. DARPA's too sci-fi. The National Security Council staff is already too big, but even still, they're putting out the fires of the day, and they're not really looking at war and warfare as we think it's going to look in the next 5 or 10 years. If you did create it, whether it be as something to endure or as an experiment, either way, I really think you could put it under the Office of Net Assessment. It would be to expand the mission, and I would probably be on board with that. By the way, I have no real connection there whatsoever, so it's not like I'm advocating on behalf of anybody whatsoever. Alternately, you could just put it into the joint staff itself as a think tank within the joint staff. You know, truly, whether you put it in the Office of the Secretary of Defense or the joint staff, I think it is less important. What's more important is that you have this idea-creating engine within the military structure that just, to my mind, doesn't exist today.
And I guess we'd have to repeat the caveat here about you just representing your own views here. And this might sound like it's going into politics, but I really don't think it is. Because in our structure, and as a listener to the show, you've probably heard me ask this question before, because it really is important. Anytime you want to make a move that such as this in this particular area, it requires, if not congressional sponsorship, at least somebody on the Hill that if it reaches that point in discussions, that you have somebody who is an advocate or at least associated with the issue. And I really like the point that you brought up in the earlier part of the show about what happens in industry with smart, relatively young minds, people in their 20s and 30s. You know, you've got to be able to grab those people and to take advantage of the gifts and the insights that they have, as opposed to structures like the military, which is very much based upon seniority. And, you know, until you reach a certain age, you're really not listened to too well one way or the other. But when you look at the latest Congress, there are, if that argument ever comes up about, well, they're, you know, they're just 32 years old, what do they know? Do we really want to start doing that? Interesting dynamics on a bipartisan basis, really. In the Senate, you have Senator Cotton. He's 40. These are people who are all veterans. Senator Duckworth is 48. Representative Scott Taylor is 38. Representative Brian Mast is 36. Mike Gallagher, 32. So you do have a growing cadre of people who have experiences that anybody who's been involved in our conflicts for the last decade and a half have seen directly and indirectly and personally. Along those lines, do you think we have some advocates or people who can reach the advocates inside the D.C. to take this discussion and this idea outside of our little coffee clashes here and towards the lever of power that could help, if not promote this as a standalone or promote this as part of a larger action to modernize the way our military is structured and find a better way to leverage, perhaps an overused term, our intellectual capital that we have available to us, but right now is just not being tapped into.
So, yes, I am so disconnected from that party that I would be guessing at best. But I will say that I do know that there are advocates. There are wonderful advocates. Elliot Cohen, who has a new book out, The Big Stick. It's already halfway through it myself. Has testified before Congress on this very point. He's actually testifying before Congress, I believe, this coming week again. And he's lamented the promotion system that doesn't seek out exceptional young talent. I mean, it's almost silly that we don't believe that you can have a real strategic idea until you're in your early to mid-60s or, you know, at least in your late 50s. When in the Second World War, General Curtis LeMay was leading the effort in the Pacific, you know, bombing 65 Japanese cities into submission, and then later commanded Strategic Air Command, you know, all in his late 30s and his early 40s. General Grant was very, very young. He was in his early 40s when he was in command of all Union Army. So I think there's a tradition there, but truly, there is sort of a bureaucracy within the profession, which is, sounds like it's an oxymoron, but it's a true statement, that does really lean heavily on age and credential as opposed to the power of the idea. So I think that there are advocates. I think there are folks that see this out there. I think there are folks that know that you don't have to wait until you're in your 60s to be of value to national security and strategy. But whether or not those folks I can pin the tail on those particular folks within the political elite. No, I really couldn't do that for you. I wish I could. I'm out here in Colorado Springs, not in D.C.
Well, it's interesting to use Grant. I always use Grant as an example. I mean, here's a guy who basically got bounced out of the Army and then fails at every civilian job and gets brought back in to become an instant success. But that raises the other question is, you know, with the career path that most of us had or currently have to follow, where you have to hit certain wickets to get, of course, I'm going to speak from the Navy side, but you have to be a certain level to get command. You have to be a certain level to, you know, certain joint professional military education stuff. You have to have all this stuff jammed in. And now, are you going to call people out of that system? And what's that do to their career path? Are they going to be, you know, designated as really brains of the Army, Navy, Air Force stuff forever? Or are they going to have a chance to go on and get those command tours and stuff that most of us while we were in service were really trying hard to get?
So, in short, there's risk to the individual, and in my mind, the folks that have advocated for this before, and I mentioned in the essay Jim Thomas of the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments and Admiral Stavridis, both I believe advocated a system where folks would be selected for a general staff, but then would pop back into their service to maintain their green credentials, blue credentials, and whatever color, you know, khaki credentials would be affiliated with the Marine Corps. But there's risk to these folks, and I absolutely I think that's true. But then again, I think that the people that would be drawn to such an organization would be willing to take those risks. And I fall back again on the Asimov article that I mentioned, and your listeners should really go look it up because it's a brilliant short essay. I mean, he's Isaac Asimov, but you know, he's talking about these people that create new ideas being at their core deep in their expertise, but pretty unconventional. You know, that someone that's willing to fly in the face of current reason and authority and common sense to create any new idea, they're already going to be sort of out of the norm. And so I think, you know, you would probably find folks willing to take that sort of a risk if they believed that those that this was truly going to benefit national security, that this would be, you know, that those ideas that they had forever been that had been marginalized and minimized in the past might actually get heard. So I think it is a risk, though. I think, you know, we should be under no illusions about that.
Just realize what the time was, Matt. Man, what a very quick hour we've had. First of all, again, appreciate you taking an hour out of your Sunday afternoon to come join us. And early on the show, we pointed the listener towards mlcavanaugh.com and, of course, on Twitter at mlcavanaugh. But what are people could expect in 2017 that you're looking at writing on soon? And you mentioned you were reading a book early on, so I thought I'd throw a curveball at you. And if you were going to recommend one or two books to people that you think they should read early this 2017, what would they be?
Well, one book, and actually, this is cheating. I'm cheating. So the War on the Rocks book list, there's a book that I recommended for their annual holiday issue by Neil Gaiman, and it's called The View from the Cheap Seats. And Neil Gaiman is a British author, and he's just an amazing storyteller. And I think in a lot of ways we overlook this, but strategy making is storytelling, and I think that would be of great value to folks. So I would highly recommend that. And the second book that I would recommend is the book that I'm actually co-editing and writing. It's called Legends of Strategy: How Star Wars Explains Future Conflict. It's an edited volume with expert strategic analysis and commentary centered on the seven films of the Star Wars universe. And there's 30 folks that we've gathered together that will engage subjects ranging from Yoda's strategic leadership to Ewok insurgent tactics, including folks like B.J. Armstrong, August Cole, Max Brooks of World War Z fame, and all of the services. So, you know, watch this space. We're hoping to have a publisher in this coming month and then to have it out by the end of the year.
Well, Matt, I'll pray for you right now for all the Star Wars geeks that are going to send you hate mail, but that's a beautiful idea. I've seen sketches a few people have done things. That's going to be a fun read. I look forward to that.
Well, I sure hope it is, and I promise, I absolutely promise that I will get a copy to you guys because, I can't say it enough how much I appreciate what it is that you guys do.
Well, thank you very much, Matt, and a ditto here back at you. And thank you very much again for joining us today, and we'll be keeping track of you this year.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Matt. I also want to figure out from Star Wars what idiot designed those stupid walkers that can be defeated by somebody wrapping things around their legs. But that's just me, I know.
Well, those were a pretty bad idea, and I think actually Brett Friedman, the Marine Corps writer, it might be tackling that subject in the book. That's just another teaser for you to pick up the book when we've got it on the shelf at the end of the year.
Super.
Beautiful.
All right. Thanks a lot.
And thank you, everybody, for joining us for another edition of Midrats. We look forward to more visits with everybody during the course of 2017. And in honor of our guest today, thank you very much, and have a great Army and Navy Day. Cheers.
It's a long way to Tipperary.